Jeanette.
Hi, Rachel. How are you today?
Good. How about you?
Doing great.
Thanks for stopping by.
Absolutely. Glad to be invited.
Yeah. So Coffee and Conversations with Rachel. What is your favorite coffee go-to drink?
Well, it isn't this one because there's nothing in the cup. I like any kind of latte. I like any kind of cold brew. I just really like coffee. It's my go-to.
It's your go-to. Is there a place you like it from?
Any place is good. I'll even drink McDonald's coffee, but I think I go to Starbucks most often, but I also like Summer Moon. It's right near our house, and there's another one that I can't remember the name of right now, but it's black something, and I like that a lot. So, like I said, anything that's expensive and that you can't make at home, generally okay. is what I like, yeah.
I do love a good Summer Moon, like chai tea there. But
yes. My husband likes the hot chocolate.
Oh, okay. I haven't had the hot chocolate. Really, I have to let my kids try that sometime.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we are starting our new series on neurodivergent, and I heard you're like a very good resource for that. So I would just love to hear your background on it, just your background on how you know so much about this and just what we can do to support and everything like that.
Okay. Neurodivergency is a relatively, I think, new idea to the mm-hmm. mainstream public. But people have been neurodivergent forever. So my background has been totally in neurodivergency. I started as a communication and language disorder specialist, actually in Coleman, Texas, in Brownwood, mm-hmm. Texas, and in Winters, Texas, while Bruce was working on his biblical studies master's. I also then I've been a teacher of autism and a teacher of students with emotional disabilities and a teacher of students with learning disabilities and with kids who had emotional and behavioral issues. Then I was an administrator as an assistant principal, and then I was a principal for a number of years. I've been in schools in Texas and in Virginia, outside of D.C., that was the majority of my career, and then also in the Charlotte area, where I was a principal at two different schools. All of my schools had populations of students who were identified as special education students, but of course, there's neurodivergent people everywhere.
Yeah.
So actually, globally, 20% of people have some kind of neurodivergency. So if you're having dinner with your family, there's a good chance somebody at that table mm-hmm. is neurodivergent in some way. The idea of neurodivergency, as opposed the contrast in being neurotypical, is that the language of neurodiversity is neutral, because people can be neurodivergent and live wonderful lives and actually have strengths and talents, the things they can do better than neurotypical people can. Mm-hmm. But our world has been geared around what's typical. And so neurodivergency can include a variety of things. Not everyone agrees on what all the classifications are, but neurodivergent people can be people on the autism spectrum. It can be people with cognitive delays. It can be people who are dyslexic, problems with reading, problems with writing, problems with math, even problems with movement in your body. It can be people with sensory problems, not meaning acuity like I can't see or I can't hear, but more how do you process that visual information. You see that a lot with people on the autism spectrum, where certain things are way too bright, noises can be too loud. I think mm-hmm. we all kind of know about that. Also, ADHD is another one. Obsessive compulsive disorder is another one. So there's quite a range. It's anytime your brain doesn't work the same way as most of the people. And what I love about the terminology, as opposed to less than, more than, or better or worse, or inferior, superior, is that it's actually not true. There are people that are on the autism spectrum that have very highly developed skills in engineering or computer science or in even architecture, or there's so many strengths, but it's a shift in our mindset about how we look at people and how we think about their strengths. So a thing that I love is that neurodivergency is not a category or a label. It's just a truth, you know, and we're all neurodivergent in some ways. Like, say for me, I'm someone that has some sensory issues. So I thought I'd get panicky on a plane. Uh-huh. And I thought, what is wrong with me? What is this about? What is whatever? Well, what I learned about myself is that certain noisy environments cause me to feel anxious. I mean, it's like a physiological response. I can be in a crowd, say at a concert, and I'm fine for a while. Then it's too much and I've got to get out of there. So I bought noise-canceling headphones that I always wear on a plane because it's that roar of the plane engines and the noise of the people, very agitating to my body. Put on the headphones, I'm fine. So I actually am not afraid of flying. I just don't like the noise. So there's so many things like that that most of us have if we think about. So I love that the shift is away from categorizing people and putting kids who might have a special need on the other side of the school where nobody sees them, to know you're one of us, we're all the same. And we need to find out how you learn, because everybody can learn on some level, and find out what you need, how do we accommodate you so you can have what you need and so we can have a relationship. So that's kind of the big brush view of what neurodiversity is, but the idea has been around for a very long time, since the 90s.
So you've been in the school system since the 70s. So how have you seen it change over the years?
So one way is that I don't ride a dinosaur to work anymore because I'm so old. But also, I'll take, for example, one of my very first communication disorder jobs that I had, and then another one that I was teaching a classroom of kids that were cognitively disabled. And this was in rural, small town Texas. Well, a lot of the kids that I served were actually migrant farm workers' kids. So there was a poverty element there, but it was determined that they were actually cognitively delayed using the old language of mentally retarded, and it was because they couldn't speak the language.
Wow.
And their experiences, so if you spoke to them in English, they couldn't learn anything because they didn't speak English. Uh-huh. So of all the kids I had in that room, only one was truly cognitive delayed, and she had a medical syndrome. The other kids were not. And so that's probably the biggest example, that if we don't know what to do, we put somebody in a box and put them over here. And there's a lot of fear involved in that. So I think through the years, and I've seen it transition where kids, to the point where kids were included as much as they could be. And there's a part of me that always thought in my heart of hearts, well, yeah, you know, why is this a big deal that we're promoting inclusion? Because everybody should be included to the degree that honors who they are, you know, in a respectful way. So I also think that something that has changed just even in the hiring process, and I think this is true for companies as well as schools, there are neurodiverse people that are teachers in schools, because certain content areas, they're just really, really good at it.
Yeah.
And so the process is just more respectful to say we're all different. Most teachers tend to be auditory. And for kids with autism or certain kinds of processing disorders, this is really a problem. Mm-hmm. So kids have got to be, teachers have got to learn to be more visual. I've seen that happen with second language learners just being incorporated into a classroom where you provide a lot of visuals so people can understand. So I think teaching has changed through the years, but in so many better and respectful ways.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. Just we're open to more things and educating ourselves. I'm like, okay, well, this person may not learn this way. Like I'm willing to, what can we do better to like make them
exactly
learn things more?
Exactly. Because as a teacher, I think old school thinking about a teacher was that you have content you are presenting. If they get it, they get it. If they don't, they don't.
Yes.
But actually the heart, and probably you may have experienced that even in high school when you were there, or like you had that teacher that was content driven. But then my point was always, and they were proud of those kids who didn't make the curve. They were proud that, oh, my test was so hard. No, actually, everybody should have made an A if you're teaching.
Yeah.
So I think that's a big shift that's happened also in schools.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I do feel like they do a good job of now at the end of the year, like, what does your kid need? How do they thrive? So then they can kind of base that off of the teachers and kind of put your kid in a class where they think they're going to do good.
Absolutely. And I think that especially in elementary schools, they have a certain process. I don't know about Texas. I taught in Texas early. Yeah. That was back in the 70s. But I think that understanding the social and emotional well-being of your child And parents know their kids better at home. Teachers mm-hmm. often know the kids better at school. But that's why the communication and the partnership is so important. And I think that's really changed, is partnership, where parents can come in and talk to a school counselor about how to support their child, maybe yes. with the social emotional issues. Because people that are neurodivergent and more things we're more used to, like hearing about ADHD or that kind of thing, can also have other medical things going on. Just because yeah. you have this broad category of things that are kind of more typical doesn't mean you may not have multiple things going on. And many kids do. Many kids yeah. do. A really anxious child can have social anxiety in a school setting. Or if you're a child with autism, you're probably going to have some level of social anxiety that's going to be wrapped up in communication and not being able to understand the cues of people around you, maybe being overwhelmed by the noise and the talk, maybe a processing disorder related to speech. You know, because when we talk in a child to a child, and we most often will want them to do something. So if they don't answer us, we think they didn't hear us.
Yeah.
So we keep saying it. And for a child, some children with autism, every time you say it again, their processing starts over. So sometimes it's learning to pause and give them a beat. Just give them a second to part. You can almost see the wheels turning. Just wait till the wheels are stopped turning.
Yeah.
You know? And so, it's changed a lot. And I think all for the good.
Yes, I would agree with that. And I feel like our counselor at our school of little kids in elementary, she just plays such a crucial role. Like she is all about that like social development. And like she has like a sensory room in her office, and she has like a habits lab, and she has so much stuff and pulls out kids mm-hmm. when she knows, you know, certain kids need certain things.
Yes.
But there is so many accommodations now when you know your kid can do great in class, but may need a little extra on something.
Exactly. And I think what's so wonderful is now whole classrooms are being set up in the schools I was in. There are kids that need, and it's not always kids that might be neurodiverse and maybe they're having a bad day or whatever it could be, because we're all human. So you have offices set up within your classroom where kids who just need a quiet place to do their work without the distraction yes. of their table mates, but you set it up for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, because it's an acknowledgement that many of us are more alike than we are different.
Yes. Yeah.
We are. We're just more alike. So I love that that's happening with more movement, where kids aren't in little chairs all the time. In the schools I was in, we made sure that the primary grades had wobble chairs. So kids that need more movement can sit, and the kids could choose where they wanted to work. Uh-huh. We had standing tables. We did all of that because we're all different. I'm a kinesthetic person. That's why I hit the mic, because I'm moving around all the time. I can't survive in an environment where I have to sit forever. So we have to, sometimes if we look at ourselves and go, well, what about me?
As an adult,
we can see connections to ourselves and go, oh, we are alike. This isn't different than me, you know, or somebody I know. And I think that's the crucial thing, is to be able to identify all the similarities.
Yes.
And then understand how to approach the differences. And also, everybody's different. So there isn't a package deal. Even for your teaching students with autism, you're going to have kiddos that may be hyperlexic. I had a student at one time that could read. You could hand him a college text when he was 5.
Wow.
And he could read it. Now, his comprehension was different. His language use was a little different. But that was amazing, right?
Yeah.
I have a little boy who was nonverbal and lots of behavioral issues. On the spectrum, was more involved and had some medical issues too. And we put a paintbrush in his hand, and he painted the most beautiful picture of a fish that I have ever seen. And nobody knew that was how he could express himself. And so he'd go to the paint easel, he'd paint all in black when he was feeling sick. We knew how he felt. Or he'd paint a fish or a flower, something he liked if he was having a good day. I hung that picture in my office for years and years and years to remind me everybody has something, and it's our job to find it.
What a gift to be able to see that. That, yeah.
It was.
I'm almost in tears. Yeah, I'm like, that is so sweet.
Or the little boy who had to pin between beanbags the first 2 weeks of school that then went on to read. Or you think about kiddos. How many kids say fire drills, okay, in a school? So how many kids hate a fire drill? How many adults hate a fire drill? So what do you do with a class full of kids who are on the autism spectrum? So we had headphones that hung by their cubby, so they grabbed their headphones when they went out the door. And then some of them went, I'll just cover my ears. And then eventually you get desensitized and they're walking down the hall and nobody's having literally a meltdown because they can't stand it. It's so painful for
them.
So it's just sometimes simple solutions. It's just simple solutions.
Yeah.
So
did you go to a lot of trainings to kind of learn that throughout the years? Or you kind of just like learned it yourself? And
I think that, no, I've gone to lots of trainings. Okay. I went through at the time, one of the school district I was in did not have a specified autism program. I was in Fairfax County Public Schools, which is, at the time, was like the 11th largest school district in the country. It's
a huge
school district. So you had lots of resources, had a lot of programs to meet the needs of all different kinds of learners, including second language and whatever. And so they were starting a pilot of these classes that would be specially set up for students with autism. And the benefit of that is there are certain needs that most kids with autism have. They need a quieter, calmer environment. Mm-hmm. They need their own privacy when they're working. They need lots of visuals to go, now here's my, they need order in their day, structure and routine. And so I was able to be able to, in that school district, set up the first classroom like that. And so I went to training in North Carolina through what was called the TEACH program at the University of North Carolina. Uh-huh. I did that. I went to a lot of trainings just ongoing with it. My background was in special education, so that was my degree. I graduated with speech and language therapy and then also with cognitive disabilities and handicaps. So that was my college background. I had massive internships at rehab centers. I've worked with all age of kids. I've had experience with stroke victims. And so my training, it's just been, and then also there's just the school of, here you are, and now we're going to figure this out. I mean, that's a lot of it. So what that's hopeful for is you don't have to have my background. I think my background gives me a different eye toward it, but you don't have to have that background to also look at someone and watch and listen and go, what do you need and how can I support you? I think we strike the word help and turn it into support, because help can sound judgmental.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to help you. Right? And that's how people hear it. I think going, how can I support you? And sometimes they go, I just need you to listen to me when I need to cry. Because for parents, it's certain spectrum disorders, certain behavioral disorders, it's a challenge for a family and it's hard for parents because you don't know what to do and you have other children that maybe don't do this.
Yeah.
You know, it's just hard. It's hard. And so sometimes the best thing that a parent might need is just somebody who'll take them to coffee and just listen. And just listen. You don't have to have the answers, but that's most of our Christian walk, isn't it? So people say, so as a Christian, what should we do? Well, as a Christian, we should be Christian. You know, we should care about people and love them. We're all God's creatures. God made people equal. Paul says in Corinthians that I become all things to all people. So if you don't know what to do, show up and give a hug and listen.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a lot. That's a lot, because people can feel really isolated and feel like no one understands. You know, if you're the parent walking through the mall and your child's having a nuclear meltdown, I don't know if you've observed other people. I had one that did that, and turns out she is neurodivergent in some ways, is a very successful person, has a very successful life. Most people wouldn't know. But she did. She was. And then the judgment, well, you just need to pick her up. And people have all these opinions. And so that's so much pressure if you're a parent. And you worry that you're doing things wrong. You worry. So supporting parents is huge.
I think we miss that as adults too sometimes. Like, sometimes you just need a listening ear. Like, you don't need to ask them questions. They don't need a lecture on how to parent. It's just like, they just need love and they just need it's going to be okay and I'm here for you.
Exactly. And so we forget about the adults sometimes.
Yeah.
But if you're the caregiver or the parent or the one who loves somebody who is neurodivergent, you have a lot of learning you're going to have to do while also managing your own family. And if this wasn't your area of expertise, you can feel really lonely and overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Because many kids have sleep disorders that fall under neurodivergent in all these different categories. They've got sleep disorders. Maybe they're afraid of medication. They don't know who to trust. I mean, there's just so many. I always have believed that God will show you. If you show up for people, then God will tell you what they need and he'll help you understand.